You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. I not only want to welcome you to Brookings Institution as the new school year begins, and it's appropriate we would have a professor to help us get started. I want to welcome you to the new Falk Auditorium. Those of you who have been to the Brookings over the years will recognize, I think, that quite a bit has changed. We have, for example, in the back of the room, I have to look down to my notes, a capacity to do high-definition robotic webcasting. And I have no idea what that means, but I'm sure that it's going to help us enlighten the public and do our good work. There's one bit of new technology that I'm very familiar with, and I trust some of you here are as well, and that is Twitter. I used to always begin these introductions by asking everybody to turn their cell phones off. All I'm asking you to do is put it on silent. You're welcome to use your thumbs or whatever as long as you're tweeting the event. And it's hashtag U.S. energy. Climate and energy are, of course, the number one issue in the world, I think, if you take the long view. There is no question that global warming, climate change, is an existential threat to the human enterprise and indeed to the planet. It is a priority of the Obama administration, and it is a priority of the work that we do here at Brookings. Hence, our energy security initiative, headed by Charlie Ebinger, who you're going to hear from during the course of the afternoon. Hence our blog, which is called Planet Policy, which is already having quite a bit of influence in cyberspace. And hence our determination to ramp up the work that we do here at Brookings on the climate and energy issue. And one way in which we're going to do that is reach out to the broader Brookings community, because there's a lot of strength and a lot of expertise there. And there is nobody in that community more distinguished than Larry Summers. Larry, as I think all of you know, has made himself a unique place in the debate on virtually every important issue that has anything whatsoever to do with economics. And that is defining economics in very, very broad terms. With regard to the climate issue, I've had an opportunity to listen to Larry, to read his writings, to discuss with him the climate issue going back over two decades, because it was just about the time that Larry and I became friends and colleagues in government that the world was really beginning to pay attention to this issue. And a couple of things have distinguished his work in that area that I want to just mention here because I think they're relevant to this afternoon. He has brought rigor to a debate that too often suffers from dogma, moralizing, and name-calling. He is a paragon of what I, at least, as an outsider of the profession, regard economics to be. And that is a field that has ethics at its very core, going back to the founder of modern economics, Adam Smith. And while he has always taken account of the ethical dimension, he also makes very clear to us what is very clear to him, and that is that economics does not have utility unless it also takes account of politics and geopolitics. And I'm sure that you're going to hear him bring that ethos and that discipline through the discussion that he is now going to open with his own remarks. So, Larry, thank you for coming back to Brookings, and the lectern is yours.
Strobe, thank you for those very, very kind words. I'm reminded of what Lyndon Johnson used to say when he was introduced very nicely. I wish my parents had been here for that. My father would have appreciated it, and my mother would have believed it. And you have failed me in only one regard, one you know from the world of politics, and that is in the management of expectations. And it would be very difficult for me to live up to those kind words. Strobe and I have known each other well now for 21 and a half years, since the beginning of the Clinton administration, when he, a polished member of the foreign policy establishment, charged with leading the Clinton administration's efforts with respect to respect to Russia and the former Soviet Union, encountered me possibly a diamond, but surely in the rough, attempting to deal with that set of problems. We have not always agreed, but I at least have always learned an enormous amount from my conversations and dialogue with Strobe. And as someone who has followed Brookings now for the better part of 35 years very closely, think that it is in a renaissance era under his leadership, for which Brookings and I think the world should be very grateful. It is said that only very hard public policy problems reach the desk of the President of the United States, because if the problem was easy, it would not reach the desk of the President of the United States. That is, I think, a good generalization, but it is, I believe, wrong in the case of the problem that and the issue that is our focus this afternoon. I believe that the question of whether the United States should have a substantially more permissive policy with respect to the export of crude oil and with respect to the export of natural gas is easy. The answer is affirmative. The merits are as clear as the merits with respect to any significant public policy issue that I have ever encountered. And it is an important test of the efficacy and functioning of our democracy whether within the next 9 months we will get to that correct solution. What I want to do in my remarks today is to explain why I think that. The first question you always have to ask in proposing change in an important public policy is, well, it got put there for a reason. Maybe it's a good reason, and so it should stay. And so some presumption naturally attaches to the status quo, and you have to have compelling reasons to overcome that presumption. What are the roots of the ban on crude oil exports, and do they have relevance today? The reason we have a ban on crude oil exports in the United States is that in the 1970s, when the price of oil spiked due to the formation and effective implementation of the OPEC cartel, we found ourselves dangerously vulnerable, and much more importantly, we responded to that vulnerability, rightly or wrongly, with a system of price controls on oil, and a system in particular of price controls on old oil. Now, if you are one country in a free world and you wish to control the price of a quantity, you have no choice but to associate that control with an export ban. Because if you don't, everything you produce will be exported. So we put this in place, this export regime, in place for a good reason. That good reason was that we had price controls. Price controls might or might not have been a good idea. I doubt they were a good idea, but it's not relevant for the purpose of this argument. What is relevant is that those price controls were eliminated 34 years ago. Now, for most of those 34 years, did this ban matter? No. We were a large-scale importer of all kinds of crude oil. It would have been goofy for us to have exported the oil. The ship would have come to our port, and then the ship would have left our port. It wouldn't have made any sense. So this restriction was like the PGA Tour passing a restriction that said that Larry Summers was ineligible to play. It didn't really matter, given the realities of the situation. The feared outcome would not materialize, even in the absence of the restriction. So we have, for the first time, a situation today that we have not had in at least two generations. Namely, that the market is sending signals that it is desirable on free market grounds to export U.S. oil. So the first thing to say is there's nothing in the history of the establishment of the policy that creates any reason for believing that it is functional on a continuing basis today. Indeed, the empirical force of this point is highlighted by the practice of what somebody called in conversation with me, and maybe it's a common term, spitting refineries. We permit, and have permitted forever, the export of refined products. We don't permit the export of crude oil. Well, as you can imagine, what constitutes refined versus crude oil is a question with considerable nuance that has enriched quite a number of law firms over time. It is estimated that several hundred million dollars are being spent each year on these so-called spit refineries. The term spit refineries refer to the fact that basically what's happening is you're getting a bunch of crude oil, somebody's spitting in it, and calling that refining the oil. And the oil's basically the same as it was before, but because it's been processed by this several hundred million dollar thing that has considerable environmental impacts, therefore it is eligible for export to some other place where it is refined again. So we are engaged in pseudo-refinement activity in order to arbitrage these restrictions, which should at least be suggestive of their absurdity. So far, I have made the argument that, one, There is nothing in the history of these policies that provides any warrant for their continued existence. Two, they go against longstanding U.S. principles constantly insisted on with respect to other countries. And three, that the purported advantages of these policies are either in fact disadvantages in the case of price or are inappropriately applied in the case of purported environmental benefits. If this were a trial, perhaps it would be time to call for summary judgment on these policies. But the real case for change lies in three other areas: economic growth, environmental impacts, and geopolitical results. So let me talk a little bit about each of them and then offer a couple of concluding remarks. Again, the various econometric studies are all over the map on the question of just how large the impact is of increasing exports. What is agreed by all is that U.S. petroleum production and U.S. natural gas production will substantially increase over the foreseeable horizon of the next 5 to 10 years, that the extra investment that will result will be a significant spur to economic growth, that the process will generate substantial employment opportunities, and that those employment opportunities will be disproportionately for the group, less educated men who work with their muscles as well as their mind, that is most threatened in the American economy. There is, I believe, no disagreement on any of that. Nor is there any disagreement that the higher domestic price that will result from permitting the export of oil will lead to more drilling. Nor is there any disagreement that the availability of export as an option will create substantial need for the creation of infrastructure, which will itself be a substantial employment generator. Optimists think that this could mean as much as 1% more GDP by the end of this decade. Those who are less optimistic think that it is several tenths of a percent. Optimists think that it could be as much as 0.5% on the unemployment rate. Pessimists think that it could be a couple tenths of a percent on the unemployment rate. I don't think anybody can know precisely the answer. What they can know is that we are a growth-starved nation, that it is now 5 years since all the TARP money was repaid. It is now 5 years since every dollar, since credit spreads were basically normalized. And during that five-year period, the United States has established GDP growth of no more than 2%. And that's with the tailwind of falling unemployment that has fallen from about 10 to about 6%, suggesting that in normal times, without the tailwind of falling unemployment, since it can't fall forever, the underlying growth rate might be less than 2%. In such circumstances, I would suggest that we need all of the economic growth that we can get. The estimates that I have just quoted have assumed normal economic conditions. if, and it is only a hypothesis, the situation of secular stagnation that I have written about in a different context applies, and if the economy is in a long-run sense demand-constrained, then the impact on output will be substantially greater. In essence, the question is, when you hire more workers to work on exporting oil, are you hiring workers who otherwise would have been unemployed, or are you hiring workers who otherwise would have been in some other job? And in normal times, you would tend to be mostly hiring people who would have been in some other job. But to the extent that we have a demand-constrained economy, you may mostly be hiring unemployed people, in which case the impact will be substantially larger. How large is what I'm talking about? To generate 0.5% more GDP with fiscal policy would require spending an extra $60 or $70 billion a year. That's a substantial fiscal program. It's one that's not likely to pass. It's one that would have substantial debt consequences if it did. And it's available to us as a free lunch. There are other economic benefits as well. I haven't added in the extra spending that would result from the lower price of gasolines, relief to consumers' budgets. Nor have I factored in the fact that a reduced trade deficit will mean a stronger dollar, will mean lower priced imports, which operates to make America richer. There is no serious argument that the average income of middle income families will not be higher in the United States if oil exports are reduced or are permitted than if oil exports continue to be banned. No serious argument at all. Second set of considerations go to the environment. I want to be absolutely clear at the outset in discussing environmental issues. Whether, as Stroop said, global climate change is the most important long-run problem in the world, or whether it is one of the two or three most important problems, along with the risk of nuclear conflict and pandemic, is a question that I think reasonable people can debate, and I'm probably not as certain as Strobe that it's the single most important problem. That it is a profoundly important problem and a moral responsibility for our generation is, I believe, beyond question. I do not suppose, and no one should suppose, that the increased export of natural gas, which would confer significant environmental benefits by replacing coal exports, constitutes a large part of an American, let alone a global solution to climate change. We will not solve climate change without moving in an economic and efficient way beyond fossil fuels. And whether we move beyond fossil fuels will not be affected one way or the other by our oil export policy or our natural gas export policy. What is true, however, is that more extensive and more widespread use of natural gas in replacing coal, assuming that the production of natural gas is carefully regulated so there are not excessive leaks of methane associated with its production, will reduce emissions in the near to medium term. The United States has a record today in terms of carbon emissions that is substantially better than anyone would have imagined plausible a decade ago. That is for two reasons. One is that the GDP is substantially lower than anyone would have imagined plausible a decade ago. That is not a happy reason. The other is that we have had expanded use of natural gas on a scale that would have been unimaginable a decade ago. There is enough natural gas to last the United States for several centuries on the basis of what we now know. And if there's going to be a planet for us to enjoy, we will not be using fossil fuels on a large scale one century from now. And so the question is whether we are going to organize our public policies in a way that enables that natural gas to be shared with the rest of the world so that it can do there what it has done here, permit the displacement of coal, or whether we are going to seek to hoard that natural gas here and allow coal exports to continue on a substantial scale and allow the new tobacco, which is coal, to take over a growing fraction of markets in the developing world. I cannot see a rational argument for the latter course. No one should suppose that export policy represents environmental salvation, but it will represent environmental improvement, and that is sufficient case for it to move forward. Third, think about Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia doesn't have that many people. Saudi Arabia doesn't have that much of what we conventionally think of as soft power assets. Saudi Arabia does not have vast prowess with technology. Saudi Arabia has been an extraordinarily influential country in the world over the last 40 years. That is for one reason. That is because of its production and export of oil. It either has happened or will happen within the next 18 months that American production of oil will exceed Saudi production of oil. Do we want the world's largest and most vital democracy, largest in an economic sense, and most vital democracy, to be able to have the kind of influence when it is also the world's largest oil producer that comes from being able to sell oil freely on the world market? Or do we wish to deny ourselves that on some a priori ground? The question, it seems to me, answers itself. Do we want others to depend on us and have all the consequences that come with that dependence, which include a certain amount of influence on our part? Or do we wish them to depend on the Middle East? Do we wish the routes through which oil travels to be dominantly those of the contested seas of the Pacific, or those that are more proximate to us? Seems to me that question answers itself as well. Strobe knows vastly more than I will ever know about Russia and the former Soviet Union. But I know enough to know that when most of the places to the West, to the immediate West of the Soviet Union, are dependent to keep warm in the winter on Russia, that creates a vulnerability that is not on net constructive in the world of today in light of recent developments. If the United States was in a position to be a major supplier of natural gas, that would affect in a very important way this dynamic. If we wish to have more power and influence in the world, in support of our security interests and in support of our values, and if we wish to have an influence that we pay for with neither blood nor taxes, I do not see a more constructive approach than permitting the export of fossil fuels. One last remark on this and then a concluding remark. Many of you will be listening to this and thinking, well, yeah, this must be right, but God, before they can export oil, before they can export natural gas to Europe, the terminals will have to get built, factories will have to get built, tankers will have to get constructed, and it's all years from now, and the geopolitical crisis is now. That's true. But I'd say two things. One is, you know, there's a geopolitical crisis now. There might be a geopolitical crisis in a few years, and probably good to prepare for the possibility that there will be one. But there's a second point that maybe comes more out of analytical economics that I would emphasize. And that is that the price of oil today has a lot to do with the expected price of oil tomorrow. And the price of natural gas today has a lot to do with the expected price of natural gas. Because think about it. If you have some of it under the ground, if the price were $40 this year and you thought it was going to be $70 next year, you probably wouldn't produce your oil, would you? And if the price of oil was $80 today and you thought it was going to be $50 tomorrow, you'd probably produce as much as you could this year. And so the expectation that things will be done that reduce the future price has the effect of reducing the current price as well. So actions that carry the prospect of change several years from now will be reflected in markets very quickly in the form of lower prices. I would suggest to you that the principle that we shouldn't have prohibitions without a reason is a reason to permit oil exports. The economic growth consequences is a reason to permit oil exports. The environmental calculus, all things considered, points towards permitting oil exports. And the geopolitics of how should the world's largest oil producer behave speaks in favor of permitting oil exports. And all four things together speak overwhelmingly in favor of permitting oil exports. This does not require a new law. Probably the best way for it to happen would be to repeal the old law that prohibits oil exports and for the government to move to a presumption of permission as long as environmental reviews are completed with respect to natural gas export terminals. But if it cannot happen that way, there is absolutely explicit language in the existing statute that says that if the President of the United States judges that it is in the national interest, not that there's an overwhelming security imperative, not that there's some kind of desperate emergency, just that it is in the national interest to permit exports, he has that authority. The president has spoken often of his commitment to act where Congress will not, and his determination to use executive authority to the fullest extent. If necessary, it should be used to remove restrictions on the export of oil. There may be policies in different spheres that would have larger net benefits than repeal of the oil export ban. I know of none that have as high a ratio of benefits to costs, because there are essentially no costs as this step. I hope that it will be undertaken as rapidly as possible, and I hope that the research to be presented later in this program will contribute to making that case both in Washington and to a broader public. Thank you very much.
All I can say is I wish we had written our report with the clarity that he spoke about the issue, because I think almost every issue he touched upon are ones that we feel very strongly are indeed supported by our analytical analysis that you will hear about in a few minutes. We have time for a few questions for Dr. Summers, and so I won't interject given the time constraints of my own, but we'll go directly to the floor if anyone has a question they'd like to ask. Yes, we have some roving mics, I think, somewhere. One's coming to you right now.
Thank you, Dr. Summers. You said that price controls have not been active about the exports of oil since 1980 or so. And given the amount of time that we've had very staunchly free trade presidents, why is it 2014 and we're still talking about this? What are the political and, if any, economic obstacles?
It's because until very recently, the restrictions have been a nullity. Nobody's wanted to export oil. It's been completely non-economic to export oil. If you had oil, it would be better to ship it to someplace in the United States than it would be to ship it to some other place. If you looked at the spread of oil, if you looked at the spread that I described between Texas oil and Brent oil, in general, Texas oil has been more expensive than Brent oil, so there's been no reason to export it. That was sort of the point of my wisecrack about the PGA's restriction on Larry Summers playing golf on the tour would only start to become an issue that anybody would discuss when Larry started shooting in the 60s rather than the 90s. And now, so to speak, Larry is shooting in the 60s in the sense that economic actors, given a free choice, would choose to export oil. And this is the first time that's been the case. And that's why it's now alive. That's why it's now a live issue.
Could we please have people identify themselves before they ask their question? One right here, and I guess we have two near each other.
Hello, Dr. Summers. Thank you for your remarks. I thought you were very, very clear. It's great how you can give a presentation without looking at any notes. My name is Steve Meyer. I'm an independent consultant in the energy industry, and I support your thesis. However, I'd like you to explain how you would address those people that are concerned that a lower oil price will destabilize the Middle East, with all the Middle East economies based upon maybe $100 a barrel oil.
First, as recently as 10 years ago, 12 years ago, the price of oil was $30 or $40. And I'm not aware that the Middle East was conspicuously more unstable at that time. if anything, the current era of higher oil prices has gone along with a less stable Middle East. So I guess the question we have to ask ourselves going down that route is it's estimated that ISIS and other terrorist groups receive $2 million a day in black market oil. If that fell by 5%, would it be a better world or a worse world? Yes, I think it would be a better world. A 5% reduction in the price of oil would take some number in the $10 billion range away from Iran. Would that be a better world or a worse world? I think it would be a better world. So I think that all of the evidence is that the huge flows of oil dollars have been more of a contributor to instability than that they have been a contributor to stability. And so I think if I hadn't been getting signs that there was a little bit of restiveness and that it would be good for me to finish my remarks, I would, in the geopolitical section, have actually remarked and presented some calculations suggesting how much less money would flow to Iran, how much less money would flow to Russia. And I would think that countries that we are sanctioning, we would in general prefer for the workings of the market to be generating less money for them than more money. So I think of that as yet an additional geopolitical virtue rather than a cost of the course that I'm recommending. In any event, Tom Friedman described this, wrote about this on the same side of the argument that I was, and suggested that it be $25 or $30. It's not right. I mean, the numbers are in the five. You know, you could argue for $3, you could argue for $10. I don't think you can argue for 30 cents, and I don't think you can argue for $30 as the impact of permitting oil exports. And, you know, so call it $5 to $10. That is well within the range of annual fluctuation in the price of oil. So it's hard to believe that that's a reason why we shouldn't, why we should maintain the ban.
We have two up here. If we could bring the mic up to these two gentlemen.
Why don't you both ask your question and then I'll respond to them.
First of all, thank you for coming today, Dr. Summers. Really appreciate your elaboration on the.
You identify yourself, issues. Please.
My name is Rex Wempen with Northern Resource here in Washington, D.C. And my question is, since you ended on the note that there should be no prohibition without a reason, I was hoping you might explain the geopolitical ramifications of continuing to prohibit the extension of the Keystone XL pipeline versus the U.S. and China and U.S.-Canadian relations. Thank you.
And I stepped far enough in it today already. My hope would be that we'll get to a better place than where we are now with respect to the question of pipelines in general and the Keystone pipeline in particular. If you think about it, we're in the 21st century and shipping oil on trains is a early 20th century technology. And the use of trains rather than pipelines to ship oil is good for Warren Buffett because he owns railroad companies. But I'm not aware that he's one of the more needy members of our society. And so I would hope that we would be able to work through the various environmental issues more expeditiously than we have, and I am very much aware of the toll that the Keystone issue has taken on relations with a crucial U.S. ally. But it's a complicated issue, and in all honesty, my impression from talking to people who are much more knowledgeable than I is that because of a variety of developments in the evolution of the oil market, the Keystone pipeline per se is probably less centrally important to the way the energy markets will evolve than might have appeared likely 2 or 3 years ago. And so I think that focusing everything on that totem is probably not the right way to think about the problem. But I think that if you ask the question in almost any area of infrastructure, and certainly with respect to pipelines, what is the risk that on the current path the United States will build too much? What is the risk on the current path that the United States will build too little? The overwhelmingly preponderant risk is the latter.
We have time just for one more question.
I'm Jim Lucier with Capital Alpha Partners. I'd like to thank you for a brilliant, clear, compelling, masterful presentation. So I really don't have a profound question.
I guess that means you agreed with the policy conclusion.
Well, no, I do agree with the presentation. I just want to make sure that I didn't mishear part of it. Did you mention at the beginning that you thought there might be a policy change or movement toward a policy change in 6 to 9 months? And if so, is there a macroeconomic factor behind that? Or even is there some macroeconomic factor we should be looking at over the next few years as the policy develops?
I was very careful to keep my remarks normative and not predictive. So I did not make any prediction as to what the administration would do. I hope I was relatively clear on what I thought the administration should do. Look, I think that the more we are a demand constraint, I think this is the right thing to do almost no matter what happens to the macroeconomic picture. I think this is the right thing to do almost no matter what happens geopolitically. The margin by which it is the right, the margin by which it is the right thing is greater the softer the economy is. Because when you permit free trade, you draw resources into their most highly valued market use, and that's a good thing to do. But if the people you draw in and the capital you draw in to oil is coming from doing something else, then if the market's sending it into oil, that's good, that's better. But if it's sitting unemployed, then it's overwhelmingly better. And so the softer the economy is, the greater is the imperative of this change. But on any plausible economic path, this is the right thing to do that will improve economic welfare in the United States. And in all honesty, I don't understand the opposition. You know, with respect to most areas of public policy, I think we should either have a carbon tax or some form of cap and trade. But I don't have any difficulty understanding why somebody might disagree with me and how they would understand the world which would cause them to disagree with me. I have certain views on financial regulation. I have no difficulty understanding why somebody else would have a view that was different from mine. They have a different understanding of how the world works, or they have a different set of values. This issue is quite extraordinary in my experience, because I don't understand what it is, what are the values that you could have that I don't have that would cause you to want to maintain the restriction, nor do I understand what your theory of how the world works is that would cause you to have a different a different view. You know, economists have a concept called Pareto optimality and Pareto comparison. And that's Pareto was the guy who invented it. That's why it's called that. And basically what it says is that if I took a dollar from everybody on this side of the room and I gave $1,000 to everybody on this side of the room, that would be a good thing to do, but it wouldn't be a Pareto improvement because the people in this half of the room would be worse off. A Pareto improvement is when some people are better off and no one is worse off. And usually in public policy, you don't have, usually it's like a textbook thing, because usually anything you do that's important, there's some winners and there's some losers, and they fight it out. Here, I don't really understand exactly who the losers are, who are very important. There's one group that are losers here, and that is if you are in the business of refining the oil that is sitting in Texas right now, you are getting an extremely cheap input because the people who have it can't sell it abroad. So you're getting a really cheap input and you're selling it into a market where the market price is set on the big world market by the Brent price. So people who own oil refineries in the southwest of the United States and who don't also own crude oil are worse off. But how that group could be, and you see that, by the way, when the Commerce Department made a small change in the rules a couple months ago, the price of a couple of refineries plummeted. So there is a very small group. But how that group could be strong enough to stand against the various interests that I described is really a mystery to me.
I'm afraid we're going to have to cut off there to get the rest of our program in, but I want you all to join me in thanking Dr. Summers for a very provocative presentation.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm David Goldwin. I'm a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings, and while it's a privilege to be a non-resident senior fellow, it's a real tragedy to have to follow Larry Summers on this topic. But thank you all for coming today, and clearly we've all followed the news of the hydrocarbon boom the last few years. First we had the LNG story, and so we had U.S. natural gas production, we stopped importing LNG, electricity prices went down, more people wanted to invest in manufacturing, and that triggered the export conversation. Do we have so much we should start exporting it? And we had a lot of studies, Brookings did one as well, which said, can the domestic economy survive these exports? And the answer was, yes, it can. The supply curve is pretty flat. And we can export and grow our own economy, and we can enjoy the geopolitical benefits. And now we're seeing a similar story on crude oil. We've seen U.S. oil production grow 2.5 million barrels a day since 2008. And we have seen, as a result, phenomenal job growth, one of the few bright spots in the economy. We've seen employment grow. We've seen investment grow. We've backed out nearly all of our imports of light tight oil. And we have become a phenomenal product exporter. So we are, as Dr. Summer said, exporting that crude, but just in a refined way. We've also produced a lot of natural gas along with that oil, which has accounted for the fact the price of natural gas has dropped so low that all the rigs have moved to liquids. And we've also produced all this oil at a time when there was enormous displacement of oil production in Iraq and in Libya and in Iran because of our sanctions. And so we have avoided higher gasoline prices by the fact that we have brought this production online. But for the last few years, we have been able to move this light tight oil. We have moved it to Canada for refining. We have blended some of it into our own refining system. And we are quickly running out of places to put it. And we see this, as Dr. Summer suggested, in market imperfections. We see it in the spread between WTI and Brent. We see it in the spread between the price of condensate here and overseas. And we see it during refinery turnarounds, when we get a little preview of what it's going to be like when we don't need this oil. And you see these huge price spreads. And that is a signal that there is a market imperfection. That is a signal which comes from the fact that we have these very old laws limiting exports. And this has prompted the export question, which is, don't we need an export outlet in order to be able to sustain production, to sustain this boom? Or if we do nothing, do we risk killing the golden goose? Do we risk flattening out this production and losing this investment and wage growth that we have seen? And so you might think that this question of whether we should export something we have in excess and import the thing which we need for our heavy oil refineries would be a simple question, International Economics 101. But given the trauma that the United States had since 1973 over oil prices, this is clearly not an easy question. And so for Brookings, as policy analysts, we undertook to figure out how to address this question and inform the public debate. And there was a call from Senator Murkowski calling for the year of study, to Dr. Moniz really challenging the industry at CERAWeek last week to come up with a justification for why they ought to be able to export, to John Podesta talking about the need for more information. And so Brookings took this on in two different ways. One was to form a task force of energy economists to look at the policy questions, which is, what does it mean for the economy? What does it mean for foreign policy? Why do we have these laws in the first place? Were they serving a purpose? How will U.S. energy security be served by either keeping this ban in place or by changing it? But second, it was clear that you needed some hard data. And this is the way the policy process works in Washington. You needed more than just rhetoric and inference. You needed some hard data on how the economy will perform. And for that reason, Brookings employed NERA, the consultants who did the LNG net benefit study for the Department of Energy, to study this question. And the model that you use matters. And this is a model that the Department of Energy and the U.S. government was familiar with. And so Brookings thought that NERA was the right place to go. And it was both a model, a CGE model of the, which I don't really understand, but of the macroeconomy, a model of the global oil market, a model of the refining market, to see how these worked. To look at the hard questions of what would happen to gasoline prices, what would happen to national income, but also what would happen if OPEC reacts. What would happen if Asian demand isn't what we thought it was? What would happen if U.S. production was far greater than we thought? What would happen if it was far lower than we thought? Because these are all the questions the policymakers need to address in order to be able to make a policy decision. And so NERA created a standalone study, and you all get copies of that outside because we gave them the parameters and just let them do their work. But Brookings has come up with its own recommendations, and Charlie and Heather Greenlee wrote that report, which you see outside also. And that was after listening to producers and to consumers and to refiners and to environmentalists about their views of this issue. So I'm not going to steal their thunder because they're going to come up here in a couple of minutes and talk about the results of these two studies. But suffice to say that the policy implications of their analyses are pretty clear. But the politics are a lot harder. And people don't always act on the basis of economic reasoning. And so our hope here is that by creating these two studies, that both for the administration, which is the likelier part of our government to act, but also for the Congress, which has to understand this issue and has to be comfortable with this issue, that by we will help to create a more informed debate, and that will result in some sound policy. So it's my pleasure to welcome Charlie Ebinger, the head of the Energy Security Initiative, to the stage to talk about the Brookings Report, and Robert Barron and Sugandha Tuladhar of NERA to come and talk about their study as well. So, gentlemen, join me.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Bob Barron, and what I'm going to try and do in the next few minutes is give you an overview of NERA's study on crude oil exports. We'll try and give you an overview a little bit about how we did the study, but also what some of the results are. And then we welcome your questions and probing in any greater detail in any aspect of the study. But first of all, I'd like to thank the Brookings Institution for the opportunity to work on this, to work with them on this really analytically complex issue. Secondly, we want to thank the Brookings Task Force, having participated in some of their meetings. The inputs and suggestions that they provided us with were instrumental in formulating the scope of our study. So as I said, what I'd like to do first is I would like to talk a little bit about what we did and then get into an overview of what our findings were. And all I have to do is push the right button, I guess, so I go to the next slide. And it worked. So I'm already 50% of the way there. Okay, so let's talk first of all about NERA's approach to studying crude oil export ban. Our study really evaluated several different proposals for lifting the ban under different assumptions about the U.S. and international energy markets. In order to analyze these particular issue, we used two of NERA's proprietary models. The first one was a partial equilibrium model, which we call our global petroleum model, which models the global petroleum markets, both crude oil, refining, and refined products. We married that, we used that model to look at what the impacts would be in the energy sector from lifting the ban under different circumstances. We used the results from that model as inputs to our new era model. The new era model is a CGE model, or computable general equilibrium model, of the U.S. economy. NERA has used this model on a number of occasions to look at a variety of public policy issues, most notably in recent times the LNG issue, the LNG export issue, and we use it again here. The scope of our study, which in part came out from the work of the task force, was to try and identify what were the key factors that were driving LNG exports. We decided we'd adopt a scenario approach to analyzing this by looking at some representative scenarios for lifting the ban and seeing what kind of impacts that led on the U.S. economy. The key issues that we wanted to incorporate in our scenarios were, first of all, the U.S. shale oil production potential. There are different views on the enduring potential here, so we tried to look at a couple different scenarios, one which was a short-term phenomena and another one in which the resource potential grew over time. The other aspect of this issue is refining. And, of course, the question here is how much of this new production can U.S. refineries actually absorb and under what circumstances? And this is really the key issue having to do with this new production and in our existing infrastructure for refining. The U.S. E&P industry has undergone a renaissance as a result of new technologies that allow us to produce crude oil from shale at economic prices. But this new oil that we produce, to some degree, is different than what we've been producing traditionally. It's much lighter. And in terms of the way oil is categorized, it's an oil with an API gravity, certainly more than 40, and in some instances, even more than 60. So the new production that we're seeing in the U.S. today is, by and large, and almost entirely, in fact, this very light oil. Now, we couple this with our existing infrastructure in refining, and we see that the U.S. refining industry over the last several decades has moved in the opposite direction. There's about 20% of the world's refining capacity is located here in the United States. And more than half of that, in fact, I think almost three-quarters of that capacity includes cokers. These are refiners with coker capacity. Those refineries are really designed to process very heavy crudes, i.e. crudes with API gravities less than 22. And that's the disconnect. We're producing very light crudes. We have a refining system that's really been designed to process heavy crudes. So we decided to look at this issue, but look at it through many different, or a number of different filters. There have been a number of proposals for lifting the crude oil export ban. Do you lift it entirely? Do you lift it in part? Do you lift it today? Do you lift it tomorrow? We looked at all of those. There's also the issue that's been raised about what will OPEC do? And does OPEC have the capability to take actions that would actually mitigate any benefits that might be derived to the U.S. from lifting its ban? We took a look at that. And then finally, we live in a world of uncertainty. So one really can't tell with certainty what the future will be. So we looked at several different futures in the international market. So let's go straight to the bottom line. So first of all, our study was focused on economic impacts. We're really focused on determining what would be the impact on the U.S. economy if you lifted the ban, one way or another. Our major finding was you get the best economic benefits if you lift the ban completely and you do it soon. We also found that if you allow exports of condensates as well as lifting the ban on all other types of crude, you get the lowest net imports of oil, which is a very important parameter in terms of determining the economic impacts. So in terms of metrics, on the oil side, if you lifted the ban tomorrow, 2015, we see a range of impacts that derive from this. All this is coming from the fact that we have an abundant resource that we can produce shale oil from. But the problem is that those prices between this very light oil and the other types of oil that have traditionally been used in our refineries, we have this oversupply, so the price will be depressed. If you lift the ban, you've all of a sudden created a new market for this oil. It can go out onto the international market and find a home for itself. The result of that would be that this price spread between the very light oils and the heavier oils will come together. This will result in more crude oil production. Depends on what your view is as to how much that will be, depending upon your view of the U.S. resource potential, but anywhere from 1.3 to 2.9 million barrels a day. The greater production, a good fraction of it, will go into exports and go off to refineries in other parts of the world. We see U.S. exports going up by between 1.8 and 3.5 million barrels per day. The additional exports reduces our net imports. And with respect to crude oil, we would be looking at a market in which we had bilateral trade. We're trading overseas the light oil, which we're not optimally designed to process, and we're taking in other heavier crude oils for which our refineries have already been designed to deal with. As a result of the greater amount of exports, the world supply of crude oil goes up. And I think, as Dr. Summers implied, if you have more crude oil on the market, since crude oil is an important cost component in the production of gasoline, you not only see lower crude oil prices, we look at something like $2 to $5 by 2020, but you also see a lowering of the gasoline price, both in the United States and around the world. So these impacts on the energy sector ripple through to the economy as a whole. Lower energy prices, improved efficiency of trade are the engines that drive these macroeconomic benefits. So we see GDP growing, and by 2020 we see it $40 to $80 billion higher. If you want to look at it in terms of a net present value over the next 25 years, we see a potential benefit of almost $600 billion to $1.8 trillion. An important aspect, though, of these types of benefits is that they're widespread. They're not focused in just any one sector of the economy, but they'll be experienced by a very wide breadth of the economy. Consumers, for instance, they'll be experiencing lower gasoline prices and lower costs for other goods and services. And so as a result, they'll be able to gain more income, $150 to almost $600 by 2020. And then in the short term, an issue that, or metric that a lot of people look at in Washington is jobs. We look at it in terms of what kind of boost can it give to returning our economy to a full employment situation. And during this interim period in which the economy is returning to a normal rate of unemployment, we see this kind of lowering of energy costs and improvement of trade resulting in between 200 and potentially as much as close to 400,000 additional jobs. And these are net jobs. So I think it's important to just take a minute and just go through the mechanism by which all of this is happening. So right now, and this is going to become more severe in the future as this shale resource becomes more developed, we have this price spread between light crudes and the other crudes that we've traditionally used. By removing the export ban, we create a new market for this light oil that it doesn't currently have. That results in more crude oil production because the price spread between the light oils and the heavier oils decreases. It results in greater exports from the U.S., and that means lower net imports to the U.S. It means more world oil supplies, and more oil supplies means lower world oil prices. And because crude oil is a significant cost component in the price of gasoline, it results in lower gasoline prices. And we believe that the lower gasoline prices will be felt throughout the U.S. Finally, we wanted to test the robustness of our analysis. The metrics that I was showing you in the previous slide all pertain to a scenario in which we lift the ban immediately and we lift it entirely. So the question comes up, is this the best route to follow, or are there other potential scenarios out there that might lead to some negative economic impacts? So in this regard, we looked at a number of alternative scenarios, what-if scenarios. Some of them were geared at looking at alternative ways of lifting the ban. I'm sure many of you realize that there has been some discussion about partially lifting the ban, perhaps just for condensates, if one can define exactly what a condensate is. We looked at that. We also looked at the notion of delaying the lifting of the ban. In both instances, we found that the economic benefits to the U.S. would be greatly diminished. And in this particular metric, what I mean is the net present value of GDP over the next 25 years. We also looked at some different scenarios for OPEC. So if you lifted the ban in 2015, how might OPEC respond to that? Certainly one way they might respond is to ignore it entirely. But two other scenarios that we decided to test were ones where they either restricted their own exports in order to keep crude oil prices at levels they would have been at otherwise, or they decided to just maintain their exports and allow crude oil prices, world crude oil prices, to decline. What we found from our analysis is that regardless of what OPEC chooses to do, there's still going to be a significant positive economic benefit to the U.S. from lifting the ban. And there could be a positive benefit as well in terms of energy security, because if OPEC decided to reduce its exports, then more of the world's crude oil supplies might come from countries that might be more favorable to us. The other scenarios that we tested had to do with the world global energy market. So we looked at what happened in Asia Pacific. Some are concerned that, well, Asia Pacific is a big growth market. There's been some discussion that if the condensate ban was lifted, this would be going to Asia and feeding their petrochemical industry. So we looked at another scenario in which just the opposite happened. If what happened in Asia Pacific was, for whatever reason, their demand for petroleum was lower than what we had modeled it to be in the reference case, how would that affect our benefits? And what we found is that it only had a marginal decrease on U.S. exports, and the U.S. economic benefits were only insignificantly impacted. The final case that we looked at was a low world crude oil price. So in the other scenarios we were looking at, the crude oil price was something in the neighborhood of $90 to $100 or $90 rising to $120 over time. We looked at an extreme low case, something akin to what EIA was describing as a low oil price case, in which world crude oil prices remained in the low to mid-70s range. And what we found in that case was if you did have low crude oil prices, what it simply meant was that lifting the ban had a minimal effect. In other words, at these types of prices, development of the shale resource would be negatively impacted because there wasn't a lot of economic incentive. There wasn't that price spread between the very light oils and the heavier oils that was driving the growth in production. And so as a result, you wouldn't see a lot of new shale production. So what did we conclude from all of these alternative scenarios? Well, what we concluded was that the U.S. would be experiencing positive economic benefits under virtually all the scenarios we looked at. We could devise a scenario in which the benefits would be really negligible, which is a low oil price scenario. But we weren't able to devise any scenario in which the U.S. was harmed by having lifted the ban. So that is our kind of overview of our study. And when we go to the Q&A portion, we'd be happy to explore in more detail any aspect of that. I think, Charlie, you wanted to say some words.
Or our study, as opposed to the excellent economic analysis done by NERA, we've attempted to look at the policy implications, and I'm not going to belabor those because I think Larry Summers hit them very hard. But I do want to just reiterate that already the unconventional oil revolution in the United States has had a dramatic impact on the global oil price, which I think many people don't realize. If we consider that roughly U.S. production since January 2011 has risen about the same amount as the oil we have lost from various places in the world because of insurgencies or other political conflicts in places as diverse as Nigeria, Libya, South Sudan, Yemen, Iraq, the list goes on. But had we not had that unconventional production, and not just crude, but the NGLs and some biofuels and other things totaling, when you put it all together, totaling close to 4 million barrels a day, we probably would have seen a dramatic price shock from that oil that had been removed. So I just want to reiterate what Larry said. Major conclusions of our report is that lifting the ban clearly by allowing U.S. producers to connect to global price signals. This will not only sustain U.S. oil production, because revenue will be generated that the industry will be able to bring back and invest in new wells, new infrastructure with all the attendant benefits that Larry highlighted. We diversify global supplies in a way that we have a new source of non-OPEC oil on the market, as he said, one that's not necessarily as potentially disrupted as sea lanes might be over conflicts in Northeast Asia, the Persian Gulf, whatever. I think, and our report certainly highlights this, we see directionally a decline in gasoline prices, which one of the things we hear when we talk to people on the Hill, particularly senators and congressmen, well, we can't do this because what if it raises gasoline prices? As Larry said, IHS and ICF and other studies have all reached the conclusion that gasoline prices will not go up but will decline, albeit very marginally. I don't want to overstress the benefit to consumers from that. But that's one of the arguments we hear. We've been doing some briefings the last few days. The White House, DOE, this is what people think may happen. So we've got to try to dispel people of that idea. I think U.S. crude oil exports will reduce the volatility of global oil prices by allowing the U.S. supply to respond to global changes in demand, particularly as Larry suggested, not today or tomorrow, but if we build out the infrastructure over time, something like the Ukraine crisis and Europe's concern about Russia cutting off gas would certainly be alleviated. Obviously, by supplying grades of oil that others can use that we cannot, we improve the overall economics of global supply and also supply diversification. And as Larry highlighted, to the extent that incremental oil demand is met by non-OPEC production, OPEC is going to have to respond in some way, although how that will occur, I think, remains to be seen. I would just hit a little harder than even Larry hit it about the long-standing U.S. commitment to free trade. We have led the charge for free trade in the post-war era, and this policy of having the ban on crude oil is simply at sharp variance at that. I happened to go to a meeting just this morning on the trade negotiations with Europe, and without quoting the person directly, a very senior European official said, if we don't have an energy charter in TTIP, there will be no TTIP. So, and this is from one of the Europeans' highest levels officials in international trade. So those are the kind of conclusions we have. We're now going to have David pose a few questions, I think, to the panel, and then we want to go to the floor as rapidly as possible.
Terrific. Thanks, Charlie. Let me come back to you, Bob, or Sugandha. You talked a lot in your study about the impacts in 2020 or throughout the outlook period, but Washington's really a kind of a here and now place. So imagine we're presenting this report to President Obama, and he says, so what's this going to do in 2015? I lift the ban tomorrow. Tell me for 2015, what's going to happen to GDP? What's going to happen to gasoline prices? What's going to happen to employment? Are you able to predict, and what's the impact? And if you can break it down into labor or investment, all to the good.
I think in terms of the energy impacts, they're going to be slightly greater than the numbers we showed for 2020. So in the 2020 frame, we were showing I think 4 to 10 cent impacts in gasoline prices. I think here, if it was lifted immediately, the effect you would see is more in the 8 to 12 cent. It's a small change, but it's a little bit more substantial. Same thing is true with world crude oil prices, where we were showing $2 to $5. We would be getting, from our analysis, more like $4 to $6 impacts. So a lot of that has to do with really just the short-term versus the longer-term elasticities.
And then what about the GDP impacts? How does that break down?
Right. I think if you look in our model or all the results that we certainly have reported all the GDP numbers. And looking at the case, in the reference case, when we lift the ban completely and immediately, I think we see about the GDP impacts is to the tune of $66 billion for the reference case. And if you're in the high oil and resource case, then that sort of benefit, net benefit in terms of GDP could be about $90 billion. So
in 2015?
In 2015 alone. So I think that's the range we are looking at. And it certainly varies as we sort of, depending on the reference case or the high oil and gas resource case, we certainly can have a time dimension, time-varying nature of GDP impacts over time. Reference case, we see a diminishing returns, while in the high oil and gas return, given that we'll be exporting over the longer horizon, our GDP impacts would be increasing over time.
And Charlie, you know, people like to keep score here, sort of winners and losers. So clearly, you know, we lift the ban, we get to export more, this is good for us. But, you know, looking around the world geopolitically, you know, who are some of the winners and losers if we jump into the market as early as, say, as 2015?
Well, I think OPEC probably would be a loser, as Larry was highlighting. Obviously, that is a differentiated group on within OPEC. Some countries we might wouldn't mind seeing hurt a little bit. Others we might not like to see hurt too much. But clearly, as he said, some of the countries like Iran would be hurt, I think, potentially very severely. Obviously, we probably wouldn't want to see Iraq hurt since we're trying to rebuild the country. Russia could theoretically be hurt somewhat, but their market may be somewhat insulated since most of it's going to the European market, although if we could offset that, that would be good. They clearly, sectorally, as Larry said, some of the independent refiners will certainly be hurt beyond the geopolitical question you asked. But, you know, in my view, they're getting ridiculous subsidies now, and that there really isn't any real market justification for or any intellectual argument for. So, and producers are being hurt, but the producers own the asset, and personally, I think they ought to be the ones that benefit. You know, to the extent that we lower crude prices even marginally, some of our allies that are massively dependent on imports, like Japan, Korea, would see some offsetting benefits. So it would certainly be to their geostrategic interests.